From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media, this week in Monrovia, to learn how Liberians cover Liberia.
You know, we are the kind of people that when we don't see, we won't believe.
It was like a nation of national inquirers. There was no media house that said, this is what really good journalism is.
There was a rush by the government to prohibit and restrain individual and collective freedoms without any reflection on what we had experienced before in this country.
The motorbike drivers will tell you that they don't stop at Genewonde because of what is going on. They believe that the town is cursed.
If we don't tell the people what's happening here, they will continue doing what they're doing. It's going to be like a recurring dream we're having.
Coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone reporting this hour from Liberia, where the spectacular beaches are closed because of Ebola, where people so exuberant they have a national handshake shrink from touching each other, where politics are so roiled that some fear a constitutional crisis, where memories of a blood-stained history weigh heavier now on many minds because of Ebola.
The Ebola had a free ride in Liberia. No road, no health, just name it. And we are such people who just don't care.
That's the fearless May Azango, who's amassed some impressive awards and death threats, reporting from what is arguably Liberia's best newspaper, Front Page Africa. OTM producer Mira Sharma and I are shadowing that paper this week to see how Liberia's story is reported by Liberians.
We are always complacent and we are quick to forget. So when Ebola came, we were saying government. I can tell you that a lot of people said it. Government just wanted to create an avenue to eat more money.
Out of Western countries.
Yes.
So they invented this.
No such thing as Ebola. They said it was government way of scaring people and blowing false alarm to get more money. But until Ebola started to kill hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, we are the kind of people that when we don't see, we won't believe. When they are shooting guns, instead of you running from there, you say you want to go and run and see where the bullet flying from. That's the kind of people we are. We want to see it.
Front Page Africa was the first Liberian paper to print pictures of the dead and the dying so they could see it. And we'll see it too. But our story starts, of course, at the airport.
Welcome to Liberia. You please wash your hands and do your temperature. You welcome, you wash your hands and do your temperature. Wash your hands this way, ma'am, please. This way, you wash your hands and do your temperature. You welcome.
Next morning at the hotel, breakfast with May and Front Page editor Rodney Sia. Lately, he says, the Front Page Africa staff earn extra money for the paper by fixing for foreign reporters. That means guiding them, setting up interviews, and often, this was a surprise, interpreting.
The major problem they have is the accent. I mean, it's English, but it's colloquial. So if you slow to catch on, you think they're speaking Greek to you.
Give me some sayings. You not sitting now here? Are you not going to sit? What a woman all over the place for? Why are you all over the place?
Like, for example, they go to those Ebola places, and the big thing they will have problem catching is debali, dead body.
The woman
is ill.
The woman is ill. It means the woman is sick.
So, Rodney, what are your plans for today?
Well, today's supposed to be the biggest holiday in Liberia. It's called Tubman's birthday.
William Tubman?
He died in 1971, but he ruled for 27 years, which makes him the longest serving Liberian president. This day became the biggest holiday in Liberia.
You said it was kind of like America's 4th of July?
It's even bigger than Christmas here. People leave their houses as early as 7 o'clock in the morning. They set up tents on the beach. They have parties on the beaches. People look forward to it every year.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the Ebola this year, the government has said, no one should go on the beaches. So me and I will go around and see if we can find some action.
Where's the Miami Beach?
Where they wrote the Miami Beach, man?
Miami Beach. The managers, the workers are desperate because the government has closed the beaches not just for the holiday, but until Ebola leaves Liberia. Fancy hotel beachfronts aren't patrolled, nor clubs, nor markets. Rodney's subtext is that these public restrictions are unevenly applied to the poor.
So welcome to Miami Beach.
What is your name again?
My name is Lafis Wembati.
What do you do here?
I have a beach business here.
And how is it affecting you?
Very horrible. We agreed to close down, but now the government is saying we should lock down for real until Ebola leaves Liberia. If you want to close down a beach, close down every activity that will cause crowd. Even a party, even a mosque, even a church.
Even a wedding.
Anything you think that will cause more than 5%, it should lock it down.
Rodney's sympathy for the men who may have lost their livelihoods is paired with a countervailing concern that Liberians are growing cavalier about Ebola. Though the number of new cases has dropped to 50 a day, it's appeared in every county. Front Page Africa wrestles with that. When the 14-week state of emergency was lifted last month, Monrovia seemed to be drifting into a new normal. There's chlorinated water for hand washing in front of shops and public buildings, but people again throng the markets and ride three to a motorbike. On the day we landed, Monrovia was locked in an epic traffic jam as young people rallied in the streets for former soccer superstar, now Senate candidate, George Weah. At our Sunday breakfast, Rodney said that would be Monday's lead.
What's the headline?
Ebola, not real in politics. We've all seen how people die from Ebola in Liberia. But you had this rally yesterday where thousands of people were in the streets celebrating. They took the shoes off, walking barefoot. They had like shirts off, holding each other, hugging, kissing in some places. And just the congestion, it's like for a day, Ebola was not real. So we want to illustrate that in the headline, in the story for our paper on Monday.
Front Page Africa seems to be determined to remind people that this crisis is far from over. Why do you think people think it is?
That's how Liberians are. They're quick to forget. The president has been saying the last couple of weeks that she wants Ebola to be over by December, by Christmas. But the American ambassador, Deborah Malak, said she wasn't happy with the statement the president made.
So the ambassador is concerned as it sets up a false sense of expectation and may actually have the impact of diminishing the safety precautions you take rather than heightening them?
It does. It does. And that's going to be a key thing going forward. Everybody wants it to be over with Ebola, but Liberia cannot be officially declared Ebola-free until our neighbors, Sierra Leone and Guinea, are declared free. Someone can cross over the border and come back in Liberia and infect somebody else. So that's why it's important to have this message. It's not over.
I just want you to describe what it is we're doing today and where we're going.
We're on our way to one of the few Ebola hotspots in Liberia. It's called Genewonde in Grand Cape Mount County.
Now we're on a road trip with Wadi Williams, Front Page Africa's newsroom chief, following up on a piece she did last month in a rural village.
We might see maybe sick people being taken out of their homes, and we might also see families who are mourning their loved ones.
Do we know why it's still a hot spot?
People are still in denial. You know, they don't believe that it is Ebola that's killing their family members. And so they do secret burials. That's where the problem is. Because once you bathe a dead, you know, Ebola victim, you definitely will infect a lot of other people.
Why do they not believe that it's Ebola?
Probably they haven't gotten the message yet. And, you know, it's a remote town. You will see that it's very far, you know, from the rest of the city, from the rest of the country. And you will see that when we go along the way, you will not even see buckets, you know, for hand washing. Some of the villages, there's only one bucket for everyone, you know, to wash their hands. So it's really difficult, you know, for them.
so bumpy. And we're being thrown back and forth across it and across the car. And I get to ride in the front seat. And the people in the back seat, including Mira, have no idea.
Yeah, you consider white. Oh, look here. White. Oh,
Chinese. Close I would be to just barfing up all over them.
Everyone with clear color.
The road to Jenewunde is very, very bad. You have to have a four-wheel drive, a really big vehicle, to be able to get in there. You have to get on a motorbike, and then the motorbike drivers will tell you that they don't stop at Jenewunde because of what is going on. They believe that the town is cursed.
May Azanga's traveling with us too, and sports reporter Macaulay Sambai, who's from the area and can speak Vai, the local language.
The town chief for Jenewunde is a woman. She's one of the few women, you know, leaders in the rural areas.
What? It never used to happen before. Never. What? Who are you to leave your kitchen, warm your husband's bed, fixing food for his children, to go and do what? Make decision? Who are you?
She's like carrying the whole town on her shoulders now.
Liberia is changing.
We've arrived. Wadi talks to the young town chief, the mayor, following up on her last interview. Remember that accent issue? This will be a challenge.
Because when we came, you people, we met you in despair. Some people were crying, including you. You were crying. How you will compare that situation to now?
The last time when you came here, the situation we were in, we were confused totally, because to see your loved one, we just died. 1, 2, 3 days, you see somebody die, 1, 2, 3 days. However, the situation that we are in now, we thank the Almighty God, we're going to 2 weeks, no sick person yet, and no dead body.
We're going to 2 weeks, no sick person, no dead body. We thank God for that.
In fact, we learned one man died of Ebola right here just 3 days ago. Still, denial?
This is a very poor village. One hand pump for 150 houses, about 2,000 people, minus the 20 that were killed by Ebola. Every day they check the houses to make sure everybody's temperature is what it should be. And they're prepared to call the ambulance, but because of the roads, or because of the scarcity of ambulances, sometimes it takes literally a couple of days for it to arrive. As far as the mayor is concerned, their elected representative needs to get them more water now, better roads now. The minute they vote someone in, they'll no longer have any time for them here.
How are you looking in the house? Your husband can control you, you can control him.
She's asking whether she's in control of the home or the husband is in control.
Gender equality, we have to be equal in the house. Sometimes you the men do mad because Alain saw you. Whatsoever you say, I should go back. Hey, no.
I will not bow by what you say.
I will bring my suggestion out there.
We got gender equality. We got to sit
and discuss.
On the ride home, I get the lowdown on Wadi.
Where did you grow up, and how did you get into this field?
I grew up between Sierra Leone and Liberia. Because of the war, I left Liberia. I was 9 years old. I left alone without my parents and went to Sierra Leone, and I was adopted, taken by several families that I moved in between. My foster grandfather had a radio. He would always tune to the international radio stations. And that's how I followed what happened in Liberia throughout the years. But then the war broke out in Sierra Leone, and I had to come back to Liberia. And I did my high school press club. And when I went to university, I did a newsletter there. So I've always wanted to do journalism, probably based on, you know, the kind of life that I've had as a refugee child without your family and, you know, wanting to tell your story.
May had no use for journalism. She fancied the hotel biz.
I never wanted to be a journalist in the first place.
Why not?
I wanted to be a hotel manager, make my own money. Even in my school press club, I didn't join anything. I told them I didn't want to be bothered because I don't want to die poor. Yeah. But when the war came, the war changed everything, and I found myself in Cote d'Ivoire living as a refugee. I had no voice. The only organization that could speak for refugee was UNHCR, and they had hundreds of cases. So mine wouldn't have made any difference. So I swallowed the bitter pills. But when I came home, I saw people live the same life I lived in Cote d'Ivoire under a neglected government. So I said to myself, if I didn't have a voice in Cote d'Ivoire, these people don't have voice. So they had a journalism program at EABC, the state radio. I decided to take advantage. And then I started to enjoy it, okay?
But what about dying poor?
I know. The war made me to jump into journalism. You see, whatever we choose in life, it does not always come to pass. What do I do? I had a different plan, but life had a different plan for me.
We were wondering, Mira and I, about Rodney. He was a contradiction, a young, old-time newsman, warm but solitary, open but guarded. So I probed a little.
We find Rodney a little elusive. We can't quite figure him out.
Working with Rodney for the past 5 years, almost 5 years, I haven't been able to figure him out. I keep learning every day, you know, what actually motivates him. You see, Rodney has no wife, no kid. So his newspaper is his life. And sometimes I'm like, maybe if you had a family, you would know what it's like to wake up in the morning, you know, with kids, and you have to tend to them first before you get, you know, on the field to do your job. But Rodney will be editing your stories and call you at 12 or 1 a.m. in the morning and expects that you will be up. The other day he called me, I was about to leave, you know, it's curfew. Curfew is like 12 p.m. and I left the office around 10, and it's like an hour drive from the office to where I live, so I have to leave an hour ahead. And he calls me on the phone and says, hey, come. I go into the office, and what he asks is that, why did you use this cliche in your story? I'm like, why couldn't you just say it on the phone? You had to make me come into your office. He said, don't you ever use it again. So I haven't been able to figure him out. I haven't been able.
He will shout at me. He will say, you are suspended for time indefinite. Sometimes he gets so angry. And then after a week, he calls. So you feel you big shot. You can't come to the office. But you suspended me. That's how he is. So I would say Rodney is crazy like me. So it doesn't matter. He will blow the door. He will knock the desk. When Rodney is angry, he will slam the door.
Seriously?
Oh, then Rodney. What?
He seems so
he's a
quiet
giant.
And so restrained.
Don't push him.
Protect your family. Protect your community.
A message from the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare and partners.
Coming up, Ebola is a stress test for Liberian democracy. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The best days are coming. We cannot. We must not. We will.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And I'm trying the best I can to report on Liberia through the eyes of its own journalists, where many of them part company with their foreign counterparts is in their view of their president, Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, now in her eighth year in office. Winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, the Indira Gandhi Prize, the French Grand Cross of the Legion of Honor, and a heap of honorary Ivy League degrees, the septuagenarian former World Bank official took the helm of a traumatized nation with a 250,000 people killed and quadrupled the budget, coaxed the IMF and the World Bank to clear its nearly $5 billion debt, boosted school enrollment, especially for girls, launched a building boom, and earned the world's admiration.
Charged with a mission to rebuild a country broken by more than two decades of civil war, President Johnson Sirleaf assumed office as the perfect balance of sensitivity and resolve.
But a USAID report leaked this year to Front Page Africa found in her government both nepotism, three of her four sons have top government jobs, and a culture of corruption. Meanwhile, only a quarter of Liberians have access to clean water. Most live in extreme poverty. Critics say that distrust of the government fed that stubborn disbelief in its Ebola alerts.
In 2005 and 2006, we were all excited about a new day in Liberia.
Kofi Woods is one of Liberia's leading human rights lawyers who served Sirleaf as both Minister of Labor and Public Works.
Unfortunately, on Ebola, the past began to show its ugly face. There was a rush by the government to prohibit and restrain individual and collective freedoms without any reflection on what we had experienced before in this country.
You say that there have been advances in press freedom. And yet, you talked about a press crackdown being one of the areas in which human rights are being violated.
Well, I believe that there are also some deception in the commitment of the government to press freedom. There have been attempts to shut down newspaper. Most of those lawsuits has come from the highest level of the government. The president, her son, some of her relatives, and some key individuals in the Liberian government have been leading those kinds of lawsuits. The Chronicle newspaper, the offices were burst into and the reporters were arrested.
Could you tell me your name?
My name is Philibert Brown. I'm the publisher of the National Chronicle newspaper.
He's a security expert whose paper was shuttered, most likely illegally, by the cops. And what happened to you in August?
Well, I was at work. The government came there, they sent two truckload of armed police, broke the office door down, tear gas the employees, and they sealed up the place. And they said they could do anything because it was a state of emergency. There was a meeting held at the Robert Johnson Hotel. All the bosses were there, the security bosses. And it was decided that since there was a state of emergency, they were going after critical media. I was the first on the list. Rondé was on that list. I was interrogated for 2 weeks. After that, the police report came out, and there was nothing.
What report came out?
There was a police report.
And what did it say?
They said nothing. They didn't charge the Chronicle with any wrongdoing. And when we took them to the Supreme Court, they told Justice Janet that it was administrative action. So the question was, do you have the power to shut a corporate entity down? And they said no. Only the courts, after due process, could shut the corporate entity down. But because it was a constitutional matter and there was nothing on the Supreme Court docket to use as a case study, the case had to go to the full bench of the Supreme Court.
This happened in August.
Yes. August 14. We have waited for almost 5 months. The Supreme Court said the reason why they closed the place is that there's no opinion of the court to deal with this press matter. So we want an opinion of the court. So we wait. I'm fighting hard to pay my staff. I'm being patient. They went to my landlord.
Who went to your landlord?
The government. I just spoke to Minister Amara Conan this morning about it and asked him why are they being personal. You close my office down illegally. You go to the landlord. You ask the landlord to kick me out. So I'm wondering, you know, where this thing is going, because if they want to be personal, I can be personal. I know more about this country than any other pressman in this country. Okay? And if I want to be sinister, I can start trouble right away. I'm going by the books. I'm fighting for due process, so they should leave me alone. Everything I have written about the president, I can prove. Okay, and like I told the Minister of Finance this morning, if the Chronicle is open today, it's going to start reporting just where it left off. So they don't think that you're going to subdue me. Okay, I'm not somebody that you can easily subdue.
Rodney went to jail last year for quoting from an independent government audit that noticed $6 million missing from the coffers of an agriculture minister. The minister was fired but never prosecuted. Rodney was, for libel, and ordered to pay a fine of $1.5 million. Kofi Woods was his lawyer.
He had to pay the money, or he had to serve jail sentence, paying about $25 per month until the money had been, you know, defrayed. And what that meant was that he would have spent more than 5,000 years in prison paying that amount per month.
Finally, he was released on humanitarian grounds. He had malaria. But that would not have happened if Rodney had not endangered the president's pristine rep.
The press in India raised the issue of Rodney Sear. She also made a visit to Canada. That was an issue that was raised when she went to the United States. A host of international human rights organizations presented a joint letter expressing concern about the conditions of Rodney and the situation generally regarding freedom of the press in the Republic of Liberia. She was also returning from an international trip, but it became clear that upon her return home, that she was coming back home to also meet a terribly bad publicity about the situation of Front Page Africa. And there was a need for the government to act and act fast. So they did act. But they can go when they squash you. Anything you do, people must stop, people will talk. When you find the vex, when you shine the vex,
when you smile the vex, anything you do, the vex. You know, we never really explained why we latched on to Front Page Africa. Prue Clark can do that. She's a journalist fixed on Africa. Her organization, New Narratives, provides resources and support to independent African media. Rodney calls her Front Page Africa's godmother.
The real fundamental challenge for media in West Africa was that they were being paid not by their employers, they were being paid by the people they write about. Journalists are paid to write bias stories. You know, as soon as you start paying journalists a decent wage and you fire them if they take payments in any form, then you free them to do independent reporting. I became aware of Rodney and we met in the West Village and we started plotting how we were going to try to revolutionize the media in Liberia. He's that old school genuine newsman. He just believes in the truth in the media. You know, there are a lot of us, but there are a few of us who are put to the same test as Rodney has been, and he's the gold standard.
You need something else to actually pull it off.
Yeah, he's a little bit mad. Is that where you're going? No question. And inspiring in his own quiet way. I mean, when you have this, what I call a pay-for-play system, journalists don't have much regard for themselves. They see journalism as a stepping stone, and so in return, the public doesn't really see journalism as being very important. People really need to learn the role of the media. But it's also the journalists who had to learn that too, because they didn't understand the power they had. He has certainly got a lot of enemies because he has exposed a lot of dirty dealings. And in a way that, you know, you go to other countries in Africa and they don't have a media house like this and they get away with so much more.
So what is the impact of Front Page Africa on the rest of Liberian journalism?
I think it's huge. It was like a nation of national inquirers before. There was no media house that said, this is what really good journalism is. And the things that motivate us to be good journalists, prizes, pay rises, societal recognition for your courage and bravery, and travel opportunities perhaps, those things didn't exist here. Suddenly, these journalists won all sorts of awards. They broke these stories. They were changing society. They were being paid well. So all the other media houses are saying, I mean, the journalists are saying, I want that. And so they lift the standard of media just by being that role model. And many media houses here that didn't have any women journalists whatsoever. Now the women win all the major awards and do all the most important reporting. No one could say women can't be journalists anymore. You see stories about what they would once upon a time call women's issues on the front pages of other newspapers now, and they're being discussed on radio. It's not just wall-to-wall politics. If you look at other countries in the region, it's profoundly different. I don't know to my way. They don't want me to my way. Suppressing me in every day. I wish I had my own way. I want to do it my way.
Coming up, intellectual debate that's loud, impassioned, and influential, and crowded, and sweaty. Even the debaters figure they might be a vector. This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone, reporting from Liberia under the wing of Rodney Sia, editor of Front Page Africa.
See, this is LIB 24, redefining broadcasting in Liberia.
Today, Rodney, May, Mira, and I are dropping in on a live radio show hosted by the magnanimous Mary Williams.
Our guests are...
Well, we have a guest in town for the next seven days from On the Media program. It's a media analytical program that comes on NPR radio once a week. It's Brooke Gladstone. She's the host. This is her producer, Mira Sharma.
Welcome to our studios.
Thank you so much for letting us invade.
Thank you.
The reason why we're here is simply to report the story from a Liberian perspective.
Are you aware that we have another issue, actually, which the Supreme Court says there's a stay on the elections? So we're like, oh, okay, really? Why is there a stay on the elections? I've never seen anything like this before. We had an Ebola situation. Election was supposed to be held on the 14th of October, which is what the Constitution says. Now, we had Ebola, so common sense will tell you you can't hold the election. But other people said, well, there's going to be a constitutional crisis if the election is not held this year. How long are you in town for?
We're here for a week.
How are you dealing with the accent, though? Are you dealing understanding the accent?
We were having a discussion about that. The accent is very tricky. One expression is, which is... Say that again, May.
White woman coming.
So now I know when I hear that.
Yeah,
usually with applause.
Do you have a question for our guests? Please feel free to ask it. Call 0777-221111. You can call that number now. 0777-221111. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
I want to say hi to the white woman there.
You want to say hi to the white woman?
Yeah, I want to say hi to her. You know, I listen to her. Also, I must say, I find it difficult to understand her.
Rodney, the interpreter. Rodney will interpret.
You heard Mary refer to a stay on the Senate election, already twice delayed, now scheduled for December 16th. If it doesn't happen, half the 30-member Senate will be unseated, leaving 15, and 16 are needed for the final passage of a law. They could convene an interim government, but given Liberia's history of instability and civil war, few openly favor that. Then again, no one wants to get sick either. Such issues are argued in tea house debating clubs called hatai, filled to the rafters with fiery young men with lots of time on their hands. We visit one such club, the Center for the Exchange of Intellectual Opinions, which is a cement room on a crowded street with a zinc roof. The topic is the Supreme Court's pending decision on whether to delay the election. On this day, Stephen Colley of Front Page Africa is running the show.
So what is the name?
This is Joseph Jeremiah, testimony in Barclay.
What is your opinion on the elections?
The international community refer to us as stupid people.
who do not care for the life of our people. Laws are made to protect the health of our society. So if our people are not being protected under our laws, those laws can still be revisited. You cannot have this reckless virus that our people are succumbing to day by day. Even on their sick bed, you're going for election. It's laughable, it's draconian, it's ill-fated, and it's backward.
Thank you very much. Sir, what is your name?
Franklin Kasewise, Executive Chairman of the Center for the Exchange of Intellectual Opinions.
Do you think elections should go ahead or elections should be postponed?
Election must be held.
If you look at those cleverly agitating for the cancellation of election, these are people who have been calling for the resignation of the president. They are on record.
People are yearning for an opportunity to refactor themselves back into the matrix of power. They feel that establishment of an interim leadership will bring them back into the fray.
These guys are pushing for the safety of the country. Do you think Liberia is safe right now to have people clustered together, having elections and so forth?
The argument is very lazy. A very lazy argument that rests on a slippery hill. Why are you now calling for the closure of the marketplaces and all entertainment centers? Because the probable, suspected, and confirmed cases of Ebola had dropped considerably. Any attempt to now hold election before January 16, the president of the nation will be addressing a makeshift legislature. This country is bleeding. The good people of Liberia will prevail over the handful of narrow-minded and evil-minded individuals.
Thank you very much.
The information minister is coming here.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
in less than 5 minutes, you'll be here.
The next day, the center was hosting the Minister of Information.
Members of CEO, sympathizers, well-wishers, we are privileged to have in our midst today, for the first time, the Honorable Minister of Information for Cultural Affairs and Tourism. The tough-talking, very eloquent, a sophisticated intellectual. Honorable Minister, this is the Center for the Exchange of Intellectual Opinions. This is that platform that commands critical minds on a daily basis who assemble here to cross-pollinate ideas of critical national concerns. If for any reason you can boast that your government is plying the route of the red trajectory, it's as a result of the views you sample from the ambience of the intellectual centers across the length and breadth of the Republic. We are happy to have you here, Honorable Minister, but I crave your indulgence to please take the glass of attai. This substance is what we take here that stimulates our intellectual nerves.
Thank you. Okay. Good afternoon to all of you. People have asked me all sorts of questions. Minister Brown, one time you were the president's harshest critic. I am convinced the president has asked me to serve in this government, not to shut me up, because to shut me up is a very difficult thing. She said, notwithstanding your serious foundational principle disagreement, I believe that we can find a common ground by which your talent and mine can be used in the best interest of our people. And I said, yes. No regrets one day for my decision. I will disagree with you on your politics and on my principles. But as to whether or not we can work together to lift up ordinary Liberians like you, there will be no disagreement in me. I know where I have come from.
He talked for an hour, but never genuinely engaged in the promised intellectual exchange of opinions. He wasn't big on that. And yet, he insists the president is. It's clear that Rodney's view is that officials should not be given a choice in the matter. When he launched Front Page Africa while working for a newspaper in Parsippany, New Jersey, he filled it not only with original reporting, but with opinions across the Liberian diaspora.
I started Front Page Africa with one laptop. It was a Dell computer.
and I sat in my apartment in New Jersey. I had one correspondent in Liberia, then two, then three. I used my paycheck in America to pay them. Critics said, oh, you're in America writing about the government, and you're not in Liberia. It got to me, and I said, you know what? I'm going to go back home. I knew that it would be difficult because the stories we did on the internet had stepped on a lot of people's toes. When we got home, we had two arson attempts on our building to try to burn us down. People sabotaging our equipment. Later on, we started getting arrests. The first time was a commentary about a 13-year-old girl who was raped. The writer said the Supreme Court was biased in the case, and I was called to explain why I published the commentary. They asked me questions about what school do you go to? I mean, what qualifies you as a journalist? Badgering me like a criminal. And I told them, I said, without due respect, the opinion pages is like a marketplace of ideas, and you're behaving like dictators. Then last year, we, of course, got a 5,000-year sentence. I spent 50 days in the prison, 8 prisoners in the room. That was very small, and the toilet was also the shower. It's a big hole, and they had like a footstool on top of it for you to shower, and then when you're sleeping, the hole is still open. So you're all inhaling that thing from the hole, and I think that's why I got sick. You don't want to be a human being in that place. That place is for dogs.
Tell me about your parents.
So my mother had epilepsy. My father was an engineer. He was the first librarian engineer to get a scholarship to America. He was a very smart guy, but he had a weakness in drinking. So he wasn't really there for us. He would take me into the bar sometimes to watch him drink and leave me there. And then his friends would pick me up and take me home the next day. I was raised with my aunt and uncle. And they taught me a lot about discipline, about going for what you want in life and getting it.
Journalism? Why would that even occur to you?
My late granduncle, Albert Port, he published a pamphlet that had a lot of information about corruption, about nepotism.
Did it come out once a week?
It came out when he felt like writing. So he was jailed for writing about corruption.
Did you know your uncle?
I was in high school when he died. Saturdays he would prepare the church for Sunday service. And he was in the church bell hall one time, and when he rang the bell, the bees came and just swarmed him. And that's how he died. The funeral was massive. People came from all over the place. He was not a very wealthy man. He had nothing much, but he changed the way people see things in Liberia.
So did he ever say to you, Rodney, follow in my footsteps?
I think it came naturally. In high school, I worked in the newspaper. And then the war came, I worked for the BBC. And when the military took over in 1994, and they kicked me out. I went to London, spent some time there, and I went to the States. I got asylum, entered Hunter College. They sent me to Kansas City Star as an intern, the New York Star Ledger, and then the Syracuse Post Standard. And then I graduated, they hired me as my first job.
Mm-hmm. And then the horrible snows fell.
The horrible snow fell. And I moved to Virginia, the Virginia Daily News. And I came back to Jersey on the East Coast with Persephone Daily Record. And it was there I stayed until I decided that the print media was kind of getting challenging in America.
You think?
So I started Front Page Africa.
This is going to be a weird question. One thing that Mira and I noticed is that you seem really jazzed and really sad.
Yeah, I mean, besides my uncle Albert Port, my next person that I admired was my uncle Kenneth Best. In him, I saw someone who I could emulate. I could model my life after. When Samuel Doe closed down his paper, The Observer, in the 80s, I went to his house. His wife made bread to sell to help the family stay afloat, and I sold the bread. When the paper was operating, after school, I took the papers in the streets. Buy your Observer, buy your Observer. And I wanted to be him. He was in the States. He came to me to help him start the Observer again. So I started the online Observer. But there was a lot of stories that we ran that he didn't like. So we butt heads a lot of time. His friend, the ambassador to the U.S. at the time.
Which embassy?
The Liberian embassy in Washington. Mm. The audit report was done on the embassy funding. They funneled money through the embassy to the States. And we did a story about it, and he didn't like it. He told me to retract the story. I said, I can't do it. And that's how we fell apart. And I started Frontpage Africa.
Does he talk to you anymore?
We don't speak. If I see him, I will pass. Only because I've tried speaking to him, he won't speak to me. So I stopped trying. All I ever wanted to do in life was to emulate what he was doing. And I can't, for the life of God, figure out why he hates me so much. I hope that one day, before I die or he dies, we can make peace. But I don't see it because the friction has gone beyond a point of being repaired.
Can I ask whether you want to have a family?
I've tried. I've had relationships that could have been more serious, but because I was trying to start Frontpage Africa, I had a lot of people who didn't have patience. They left me.
Of course, you never let your staff off, so you have them around.
Yeah, I mean, we spend a lot of time together. I think they like what they do. When I came from prison, they had a big ceremony in the streets. There was a parade and stuff. And I broke down and crying, and people didn't understand why I was crying. It's like those people stood by me. They were offered jobs. They could have gone anywhere and left me when I was in the lowest moment, but they stayed behind because they know that deep down, I cursed them at times. I slammed the doors and crashed the doors, but they know that I try to make them the best that they can be. And that's why I think they stayed.
You love them.
Yeah.
Let me just stipulate, for the purposes of a hypothetical, that you're not getting along with your uncle now because you confronted him with his limitation. His friends, his alliances with President Sirleaf, these were things that he decided he didn't want to compromise with uncompromising journalism. Can you see at some point when you're older, maybe as old as your uncle is, the prospect of prison or the promise of an easier life, that you might find yourself in his position sometime?
I hope not. I won't lie to you. I can never say never. The reason I don't have too many friends here is like people who think they're my friends, they figure that because you're a friend of theirs, you have to protect them. And this country is very fragile. It's very small. Everybody knows somebody. I get calls every day from people who say, how could you do that to your friend? And what can I tell them? We're just doing the job.
Sounds lonely.
It is. It is. That's why people, they don't see me out. So they sometimes say, I think he's gay. We haven't seen a woman before, so he must be gay. And I take it in stride because that's the work I chose to do. During the war, I was a refugee. My epilepsy mother was in a wheelbarrow. I took her from place to place. I've seen dead bodies floating on the rivers. I've seen my friends get shot. I came close to being killed several times during the war. You want to celebrate the fact that you came back home to help start a vibrant paper in a vibrant democracy. I don't do it because I hate the government. I'm not anti-government. I am pro-Liberia. Transparency, accountability, those are the things that the lack of them
took us to years of civil war. If we don't tell the people what's happening here, they will continue doing what they're doing. It's going to be like a recurring dream we're having. They will hate you for what you write, but we need to tell these stories in a way that I think only we can.
When Rodney was arrested that second time, thousands of people filled the courtyard and the street to obstruct the police taking him to Monrovia's South Beach prison. This came up during a car ride.
Hey, Brooke.
Yeah?
It's my song.
A favorite song? No, a song in which he's named in conjunction with freedom of speech. Turns out Rodney's kind of a folk hero.
They say freedom of speech, yeah. Rodney see you talk, they care, they brother soft speech.
What was that?
Rodney see you.
Yeah, talking, brother.
He's in the song.
They say freedom of speech, but Rodney see you talk, they carrying it to soft speech. You think I joke?
Musician gospel, we had a big in the street to pay the hospital bill. They say freedom of speech, yeah. Rodney see you talk, they care, they brother soft speech.
It says something about Liberia, that even with its dismal economics, politics, and disease, there is engagement, commitment, the power to, at the very least, shame people who abuse the public trust, and the courage to do it. People ask a lot if I was afraid of getting sick. I wasn't, not once. I was careful and hanging around careful people living meaningful lives. Ebola has publicly exposed Liberia's vulnerabilities. And the higher the stakes, the more journalism matters. Even before Ebola, Rodney was making a difference here. Ebola generously brought us to him, but it wouldn't let us shake his hand.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.